Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, a violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room at www.blogtalkradio.com/crimewire. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a segment on a future case for a show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Vito Colucci is off solving crime all over the country this evening, and joining us is Delilah, creator of CrimeWire Survivors blog Time's Up and president of Imagine Publicity. Denny, take it away.
Yes, before we get into introducing our first guest for the night, I'd like to welcome Delilah, and also we have a poll up on our website about the death penalty, and we're getting some interesting responses to it. We're going to leave it up for a few more days, so if you haven't done so yet, please stop at the CrimeWire site and vote on our death penalty poll. We're very interested in your responses. And our first guest this evening is John O'Brien. John has been a newspaper reporter for 27 years, the last 22 at the Post Standard in Syracuse, New York. He covered state and federal courts for 14 years, and for the past 5 years, he's been on the newspaper's investigative reporting team. He recently was given a statewide award by the Associated Press for coverage of problems at the Onondaga County Sheriff's Office. John co-authored a true crime book in 1996, titled Goodbye, My Little Ones, published by Onyx. John, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thanks, Denny. Glad to be here.
And before we get into the main focus of what I want to talk with you about, is could you tell us a little bit about your book, Goodbye, My Little Ones?
Sure. It's about a woman named Juanita Hoyt who five of her children died in the 60s and 70s, and they were all attributed to SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. She even had a doctor who made a career out of determining that based on her death, those deaths, that SIDS ran in families. Well, it turns out 25 years later that she had murdered them one by one, and her case helped establish the idea that SIDS ran in families, which was later disproven, and ended up unearthing other serial homicides that were first cast as SIDS.
John, can I ask you, how often do these cases go undetected? Maybe the first one might look like it or have, you know, similarities to SIDS, but then maybe the person moves away and they're in a different state, different community. Is there a way to track down somebody who perhaps, you know, because they can give information or choose not to on a past pregnancy?
Yeah, that's right, and it's really hard to track. The authorities have started paying attention to it more because SIDS is really a diagnosis of nothing. We don't know. It's, you know, in sudden infant death syndrome. They don't know what causes it, so it's tough to find it until you've started seeing it again and again. And there was a couple cases of people moving and no one detecting that, hey, they already done this before somewhere else.
Did this woman have, was it, they all fathered by the same person?
They were, and he never suspected her. He always believed her when she said that the child had suddenly stopped breathing. And these children, especially the last two, were in and out of the hospital repeatedly. It turns out she had apparently Munchausen syndrome by proxy, where she enjoys the medical attention so much of having her children ill that that was her driving force, the attention. But like I said, after her case, there came out others, one in Chicago. I think there might have been 11 kids who had been killed.
I remember that one.
And she, Getzius, I think her name was, but she had got...
That was 11 children in one family?
Yeah, that number may be wrong. I may be thinking of a different family, but there were a lot of deaths.
Wow.
And that one especially, I know, was... the authorities couldn't do anything about it because they always pointed to this one medical study that said it runs in families, and that was, in fact, Juanita Hoyt. So hers spawned others.
What kind of time did she get?
She got the max, 25 to life, but she died in prison a couple of years after she went in of cancer. So
are those studies still valid as far as...
Oh, no. Oh, no. Actually, the medical journal that published it, after she was charged, and I think even before she was, well, probably after she was convicted, published a correction of sorts, saying we never should have published that. It's no longer valid. That was, of course, 25 years after the fact.
Now, let me, you're not... the first time you've been a guest on the show, and what we do is we profile cases that are either cold case homicides, suspicious death cases, and missing persons cases.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And as you're probably aware, when you have some of these cases where either the case has gone on for a substantial amount of time, sometimes years, without a break in the case of a homicide, or when you have a death under suspicious circumstances where perhaps the family of the victim doesn't agree with a ruling of suicide or accidental death and believes there may be a homicide involved, or when a person just goes missing and is never seen again. The families of the victims do whatever they can to try to keep their loved one's case alive, keep somebody looking at it, and hopefully at some point fresh information will come in, a tip will come in, and maybe the investigation can be reopened or the matter resolved. And I'd like to talk a little bit tonight about, from a reporter's perspective, what are the chances or what does a victim's family have to do with the media? What does the media look for and what types of cases they will report on or follow?
Well, in cases of missing persons or possible homicides that are not being investigated, let's take the homicides not being investigated properly. We really need documentation, some kind of evidence that we can confront the authorities with it as proof that, you know, what have you done? Are these people you haven't interviewed? There's evidence that you didn't collect. But we can't just do it on someone's word. We need police reports, witness statements, or you know, access to witnesses themselves. To launch into that is a big deal for us because we get, you know, bombarded with story ideas all the time. And we know that a lot of them are valid, a lot of them aren't. How do we decide which one to really
dig in? What do you mean a lot of them aren't?
Well, I mean, I've gone down the path where we say, okay, let's dig into this. And I'm not talking about either, this could be any story of any kind anywhere, where someone is so insistent that there's a story there that we decide to devote our resources to it and spend time, and then it turns out they weren't telling us something. This is bogus, you know, or that there's nothing to back it up. And then we're left at the end with no story at all. So we need to get what sort of like is, I call it, probable cause, that the story will be there at the end, that there's enough proof for us to go spending that time on it. And in most cases like this, there is that. There is that proof. People, if it's a wrongful death or a homicide that's been covered up, those kinds of cases, people usually have enough for us to go on. but sometimes they don't. I just would encourage people to gather notes and police reports as they go to have it ready to go.
Well, it also helps to have an NCIC number. It also helps to have, you know, get the case. A lot of people don't know to get the cases registered, you know, to get that police report and get it in the national database. You know, that's important. I mean,
mm-hmm.
and they don't realize how important and how easy that would be for you guys to check as well.
Yeah. I think sometimes people just assume that someone else is doing that, you know, but they have to take their own initiative.
So basically, when you're looking at a story for, you know, for any one of these crimes or for a missing person, you're almost looking at it from an investigative standpoint. You have to go through a lot of the same steps that an investigator, on a police department, would have to go through to verify all the sources and all the information before you can run with a story.
Right, and if you think about it, if we didn't do that, we'd end up spinning our wheels on stories that end up never getting in the paper, and then we lose out on the stories that we could have gone after, and they would have been there. And a lot of times, it doesn't mean that the person isn't telling the truth. It's just that you have to have the documentation, the backup evidence.
What about in a missing persons case? Because one of the things that is so important for the families of the missing person is to get that information out, to get it into the newspaper. Where would they start with you? As far as, you know, their documentation, they have police reports and so forth, but how do they keep it in the limelight? How do they keep the public's interest in that story so that it doesn't go cold?
That's a good question. It depends on what's going on, obviously. If it's a runaway, you know, if it's, say, a 21-year-old person who just ran away, then we're not going to probably do a story on that. If there's evidence that someone was, there was a crime involved, I mean, that's a different story. And I guess to keep it going, you know, like a year later, 2 years later.
But see, this is where a problem comes in, especially with missing adults, is the fact that, you know, it's just not considered newsworthy or even worthy to be investigated because there's no law for a missing or there's no law against an adult going missing. They can just go off and do their own thing.
Right.
However, when you have information from a family member that this is totally against their character, this is where we run into problems and see this quite often, is that it's totally ignored. Is there any solution there? Is there anything that a family member of a missing adult can get to you to make that case more important, to get you to look at it?
Well, I guess I'd want to know more than just a feeling that it's something that they wouldn't do. I mean, that's good to know, but then, okay, but, well, what do you mean by that? Have they never done anything like this? Were they not having any kind of problems with another family member? Did the police look into it, and what did they find? What evidence do you have that something really bad has happened here? I mean, I think we need more than just a hunch.
So, John, if there was someone in your area covered by the Post Standard who had a case like we've been talking about, a missing person.
How old is the person? Let's do that. I mean,
you know what? Let's take Mary. You know what, Denny? Let's take Akronek.
Okay.
Mary.
Kelly Sue
Akronek. New York vanished, disappeared. There was a fire. The glasses were on the sidewalk. You know, he was a part-time fireman. We've had her on the show. That was a case that you know, didn't get enough attention as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, to me, immediately when there's a suspicion of intimate partner homicide, which is what I call it, because domestic to me doesn't mean, that means a handkerchief, a blow of the nose, they don't care. So it's a potential based on other factors in the case. And you know, for the family member to go and get information or to get a reporter or the police to really, you know, get moving on it, it was very difficult before it started. And that's frustrating for families.
Well, there you've got a fire. He vanishes at a fire. Is that
the car was burned on a road. to a crisp, and like I said, the crime scene photos, her glasses were on the ground, and there was the couple was, you know, according to family members, had some, the police had never been called, but there were some issues and different things, and he was allegedly fairly controlling. And there was just things that they had a very difficult time getting anybody to pay attention for a long time because, you know, they tried to say, or he tried to say that, you know, she ran away. If I hear one more time that a husband or a boyfriend says she ran away, I'm going to puke because we can, you know, take it to the bank that she didn't.
Well, in this case, that sounds like clearly something we would dig into.
But some reporters,
some
seasoned reporters, and I'm not talking about, I'm not speaking of you, but
yeah.
Some seasoned reporters, it's different. You've been around the block a long time.
Hey, knock it off there. I'm not that old.
And, well, no, we drink the same water. We're of the same age
okay.
and mindset,
right.
So that's okay. What I'm saying is that, you know, the younger people, because I pitch things all the time, and someone like you, I would have no problem just telling you and getting it completed and out there. But the younger reporters, they don't seem to have a sense, an urgency. You know, a lot of what you did probably you learned on in the city newsroom or working, you know, the night shift crime beat. And they don't. It's a different kind of reporting. So I just see different. I see people in your age category bracket experience much different than I see a reporter just come out of school. Who looks at the internet as, you know, something that they grew up with, we didn't grow up with, and you literally have to kind of guide them in a different way
mm-hmm.
than the way you learn because you learned on the streets.
Well, that may be true, but I mean, this is done in New York City.
Yeah.
Not
New York City. Where was it?
Johnstown.
Johnstown.
Oh, okay. So it's more near Albany, right? I mean,
I
would seriously doubt that we would pass up on that. I mean, it just sounds...
Well, then I now have your number, sir, so I'm going to be able to call you with these that I get up in New York in your way.
Well, it's not in our area, though, so...
I know that, but the other ones that I get are.
So. Oh, sure. Yeah, please do. Yeah.
But it is difficult, and families really have a hard time. You know, they don't know what to say. What is something that if somebody could give you on a case that would just make it a little easier for you? Would you like something in an email? Would you like something, you know, dropped off at the where you work, at the paper? What's the best way to receive information so that you could start perhaps even just looking over something, a case?
If you have documents that are in an email form, that'd be great. Then obviously it's immediate. But if you don't, then get them together. Mail them in. Don't expect, you know, an immediate response, but to get the lawyer or the reporter to agree to look them over and then call you on them, what you've got. But either way is good. We do that a lot. We just say to people, give me what you got, then we'll talk. As opposed to reading through everything over the phone and not knowing what is document and what is their own perceptions.
Do you see more cases now of more serious crimes than you did, let's say, 20 years ago? Has the criminal, the acts become more violent, more consistent?
It seems like it, but I don't know if that's because we're shorter staffed or I'm older. But
I think you're getting older.
I am older, but then I'm also more seasoned, so I've seen a lot of stuff. But, yeah, there are some pretty awful things going on now that I don't think we would have seen way back, but hard to say.
Does the internet help you a lot with what you're doing?
Oh, yeah, it helps us a ton. The bad thing about the internet, of course, is that it's killing our business. So, but we'll take the good with the bad.
Well, how do you compare, let's say, investigative journalism of the past with how the media coverage is going on today through, you know, through shows like Nancy Grace and everything that's on CNN and the Headline News Network and the internet? Do they really have time to investigate the stories before they blast them all over the headlines?
Yeah, good question. I think that everything is spinning so fast that people rarely take the time to really dig into a case. They do get what they can as fast as they can and get it out there and then get away from it, which, you know, it's not always good, but it's good for people who...
Or they bang on the same story night after night after night.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Like you said, Nancy Gray and Grayson, which I don't watch, but I know what she does. Yeah, like, you see that all the time, and like, they're still talking about this case? Can they move on? Yeah.
There's so many other people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, you guys wouldn't be able to survive doing a one-hit wonder, you know, every night. Mm-hmm. And people get tired of it.
Yeah. Yep.
John, when you were part of the, you're saying when you're working on a story, after you're convinced that the person reporting the story has more than just a hunch, that they have sufficient, as you, I think, call it probable cause to believe that the investigation was botched or less than enthusiastic on the part of the authorities. You say that you then, after you reviewed the information available, you then approached the authorities and asked them questions about what they did or didn't do. Now, you're dealing with a lot of local agencies, of course, and some of them you probably have to rely on, or not you personally necessarily, but reporters or the reporters of the paper to get your news. Is there ever a consideration of offending one of these agencies where you say, well, you know, we don't want to tick these people off, so maybe we won't ask them the hard questions? Is that ever a problem?
Never, not at all. And it does help to have a team of investigative reporters who don't deal with the same people every day on a beat. So, you know, we're not afraid of offending them. We're not afraid of them, you know, not talking to us the next day. But we also are very careful to be fair and you know, give them their say and go out of our way to get them to talk. Not to let them spin it the way they want, but just to make sure that they've gotten every chance to be heard, to explain themselves, and then when the story comes out, they might be ticked off, but they'll at least say, "Well, he was fair," you know. And
yes,
then they'll talk to you again.
So you get some respect.
Yeah.
Professional respect.
Yep.
Okay. The other thing I was wondering about is when you have a story you're working on, and you are convinced based on what you've seen that there were some problems with the investigation. If the agency won't cooperate with you, let's say, for example, it's an open case. And certainly with an open case, they can always come back with a thing, well, we can't say anything at the moment because we can't jeopardize the investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Even though you might know it's not an active investigation, but technically it's open. Is there any way to handle things like that? Is there anything you can do as a member of the media to force the issue, or are they... you have to kind of let them slide if they use the open case.
Well, you let them slide, but you go ahead with what you have, and you make sure they know what you have so that they can respond to it if they want to, and they know what's going to be in the paper. Sometimes they will find a way to get past that excuse. Not very often, but sometimes.
Do you ever find, John, that after you or another one of your investigative reporting team does a story, follows a story, and gets it in the paper, that there are sometimes results that perhaps the investigation is reopened or reinvigorated or that type of thing?
Yeah, that does happen. That's a great feeling when it does. That's happened. Pardon?
Oh, go ahead. Finish up.
Well, that's happened with a couple times with people who were wrongly convicted of a crime or charged with a crime,
mm-hmm.
too. I mean, the authorities mess up the other way too, but that's a good feeling, and it brings more people coming, you know, to call you with other cases to know that you got results. So
as a family member who's interested in trying to get media attention to their particular case, to their story, before they approach a reporter or a media outlet, excuse me, what they need to do is they need to have sufficient documentation or evidence to back up their contention, to indicate that there was or is, in fact, a problem of some sort.
Yes, they don't
cover up or incompetence or what have you.
Yeah, that doesn't mean they need everything. I mean, they just need something to get us to bite on it, you know, so we know it's not just a hunch. It doesn't mean they have to get, you know, freedom of information requests and get everything. But if they have enough of it for us to say, hey, there's something here, that's it. That's all, that's all we might need.
Okay, now, let me go back for a minute and just your opinion on this. Now, Syracuse is a fairly good-sized city, and Onondaga County is a big
county. Yeah, and there's 14
county.
People missing currently on the Syracuse Police Department in their cold case, missing persons, you know, not identified. I think we should take one of these and do a little experiment. I'm not trying to put down on the spot, but...
Yeah, please.
Jane Kelsey's been missing for a while now, and last, you know, August 1994, they haven't found her body. And then there's, it'd be nice to kind of do an experiment and go through one of these and just consider. I'm not saying no, because, again, I'm not trying to put you on the spot.
Well, give me a name, and I'll tell you what, if we've done anything on it.
Josephine Chapman.
Okay, go ahead. I'll look while you're talking.
Chatraw, Chatraw. He's in prison for her murder, but they haven't found her body. Or how about Jane Kelsey, K-E-L-S-E-Y, case number 94-135-005.
Jane Kelsey's been missing for how long?
1994.
Okay. They don't ring a bell with me. I'm looking
okay.
Now. And last story we did was 96 on her.
Okay, that's a long time.
It is.
It is.
They're looking for her body in the water, in the river.
But sometimes what's nice is, and because we work with the Q Center for missing, the missing, what's nice is to be able to, every once in a while, to put a case like this out, and then there's a new search or there's a new interest in the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
And 14's a lot for Syracuse.
That's probably something we should be doing.
That's correct.
Exactly what
and,
you're doing.
And perhaps maybe we could, like I said, do maybe work through a case, something like that. If I pick one out, again, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, but in the next few weeks or before the end of the year, if we can pick out a case and actually kind of report on it a little bit, what's going on with the story and the movement, and so people can actually see, how does that sound? I mean, they can actually see what's going on.
It's a novel idea. I like it. But, I think we want to know that there's something more to be reported other than the time frame that's gone by.
And we would, because, again, we'd get Q Center involved or somebody else to do that. So, okay, you're on. I like that.
So, I mean, because we've been talking about people calling us and asking us to do a story. Here, we would be taking the lead.
That's
and
right.
And I kind of like that. Yeah.
I do,
that
too.
Might work.
Okay.
Work.
And the family members would really like that.
They'd really like that. So let me. I'll go ahead and pick out something.
All right.
I'll have it to you by November. And I'll figure out what's the best to get Q Center, see if we get them involved and whomever else, and let's try this. And then
all right, we'll find the person by December. That's what we'll do.
Yeah, okay. That'd be great.
Yeah.
It's happened. This show has prompted information on cases, information on, you know, where somebody might have disclosed something, but they don't want to come out. I mean, And we've been responsible for, you know, cases moving forward in ways that they haven't even after 20-some years.
Hmm. Okay.
So, yeah, that sounds good.
Good. All right. I'll work for Denny to get to you. So.
Okay. Well, or I'll get to you myself because I have your number.
That's right. Okay.
Yes.
Before we run out of time, John, I wanted to just follow up on a question I asked you a few minutes ago about when you have to approach police agencies regarding the quality of their investigative work. Now, because you're a pretty big paper in the area, and Onondaga County is a big county, heavily populated, what about if you went to a smaller community, for example?
This sounds very familiar, Denny.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Are there any chances, do you think, and I'm not asking you for any names, but just it seems to me there might be a possibility if you're dealing with a smaller paper more closely tied to a particular agency, a police agency, or more reliant on a particular agency, do you think a smaller paper, maybe with less staff or less experienced reporters, could see that a little differently and might be intimidated?
I think they could, and I'm not going to reveal details of the story I'm working on with you, but I think it happened there. That paper wrote a story about this case, three-year-old case, with lots of questions, that had lots of questions about the investigation, and none of them were raised in the story whatsoever. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, maybe there's a reason for it. I don't know, but they weren't in the story.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much, John.
Okay.
We've run out of time. This half hour went by very quickly.
Yeah, I'm sure he's relieved, but yeah.
Thanks so much for being on with us.
Okay.
And
enjoyed
I hope
it.
We follow up with this thing about maybe picking out a case by the end of the year and see what we can do with it.
Yeah, it's a good idea.
We appreciate
anyway.
It. Yeah.
All right. Thank you both.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, John. Good night now.
Bye-bye.
Lisa Shuttleworth's teenage daughter was spending the night at a friend's home on September 3rd, 2003. She called her mother at her Aiken, South Carolina home, and they spoke at 7 a.m. on September 4th. About an hour later, an acquaintance saw Lisa in her blue-green 1994 Pontiac Grand Am at the Pit Stop convenience store on Pine Log Road in Aiken. She appeared to be reading as she sat in her idling car, which she'd borrowed from a friend. Lisa Shuttleworth called her friend at 10 a.m. and told him she was expecting a guest. She was supposed to pick up her son from a bus stop that afternoon, but did not. She's never been heard from again, and all the phone calls after 10 a.m. went unanswered. Joining us is family spokeswoman and Lisa's best friend, Joy Grooms Batchelor. Hi, Joy.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
For the people who don't know about Lisa, can you describe her for us?
She was very outgoing, lovable. Everybody loved her. She was funny. She would always light up the room. She was like the center of the party. Just the sweet. I mean, you couldn't ask for a better person. And a loving mother. She loved her kids. She lived every day for her children. She's just, I don't know, just, I kind of get emotional when I talk about her, but, you know, she was just everything to a lot of people.
And you were really close with her? Did you grow up with her, go to school with her?
Yes, her parents actually lived across the street. She lived across the street from me, and I think from fourth grade on, we were best friends.
Can you tell us about the day that she went missing? We kind of went over it briefly, but exactly, does anyone know who the phone call was from and who it was that she was supposed to meet that day or who was visiting her home?
Yes, actually, I've gotten some new information from when I talked with Miss Milano last night. Lisa was dating a guy, and she had taken a pregnancy test on Wednesday night and found out that she was pregnant. The boyfriend came over that night and said that he would bring another pregnancy test the next morning, which was Thursday morning. To my knowledge, he had to have shown up because there was two pregnancy tests there.
You mean two pregnancy tests there, like wrappers or in the wastebasket?
In the waste, both garbage, the actual test.
Did somebody save them? Did somebody secure them, put them in a baggie?
We don't know. I just hung up with Lisa's mother, actually, and she's the one that told me that. Now, we don't, and she said that she was not aware that this person told the investigators that he had been there that morning.
Well, wait a minute. Denny Griffin, hold on. Denny, how important is this to you know, there's DNA in there, period.
Yes.
Well, you know, how important is it? And then they could actually get a timeline on some things because those tests are, you know, ever since they've been around, you know, it's on a stick. They might have been able to tell who the baby's father was.
Mm-hmm. That could be
and
critical.
It's critical that that's what people need to do too. A lot of times is that when, because how much time, Lisa? How much time, Joy, went by before investigators even came in to do any investigation? How long was it before she was reported missing, and then they actually got their derrieres over to the prospective crime scene?
It was about a week, about
okay.
7 days.
A whole week. And what people that are listening need to do is don't touch anything. Don't empty anything out. I don't care if it stinks. Don't touch it. Because there's things like a pregnancy test. There's things like even cotton swabs. That maybe somebody had something in their ear or, you know, and they threw it in the wastebasket. That would show someone was there, perhaps uninvited, perhaps something in the garbage. Maybe there was a cigarette butt. Maybe, you know, Denny, explain how important that is.
Well, you know, you never know. As Susan just mentioned, don't throw anything away. It, no matter how unimportant it might seem to the person trying to maybe clean up the room or clean up the location or what have you, you never know what that one little piece, like Susan mentioned, a cotton swab, a cigarette butt, that could possibly be the key that could break a case wide open.
Blowing the nose on a Kleenex.
Yeah, all that stuff. And like I say, and once evidence has been destroyed or its value as evidence has been lessened because someone's handled it, someone's moved it, someone's done something with it, you can't get it back. If it's gone, it's gone. And if it's been degraded through a cleaning or that type of thing, you can't restore it to its original condition. So it's just absolutely critical to preserve evidence until the authorities can get there and take a look. They'll determine what is or isn't important. But like I say, it's better to err on the side of caution. Susan said if she doesn't care if it stinks, leave it till somebody can look at it.
If you're concerned, if you go through the garbage yourself, get a pair of plastic gloves, get a pair of sterilized pair of you know tongs that you would cook with, and gently pick it up, and then put it in the bag and seal it. If it's a paper towel, if it's a looks like somebody blew their nose in a Kleenex, if it's somebody's old razor, toothbrush, maybe they weren't thinking. These items that don't look like that person's. Again, you know, a lot of times, too, when in relationships, when somebody's dating or they're in a serious relationship, there are personal items somewhere. They're doing something. And without thinking, the person may have cleaned up certain prints, but they forget if they sneeze and they grab something to, you know, blow their nose with. Or like I said, maybe something, I've seen people with cotton swabs. It could be anything. It could be a cigarette butt. If you notice a cigarette butt by the landing near the house, and maybe the person doesn't smoke, or what's this doing here, or this brand, or this filter, go get a pair of tongs and throw it in a plastic bag, and you keep it. You keep it until you can hand it over to the police and say, you know, this might be evidence. Any little thing. Same thing with their car. Do not take their car and go get it cleaned. Don't touch a thing.
And as far as I know, they have not collected any evidence in this case. So to my knowledge, the pregnancy tests were not taken by Aiken County. The car that she had borrowed the man that owned it came and picked it up that evening.
But if she took those pregnancy tests real quick, then they were thrown in the wastebasket and somebody threw them out. So that's what I'm saying, that it's not anybody's fault. But in the future, you know, the people should realize the importance of that little thing.
Right.
Well, and also, it's a case where I think what Joyce even saying is even when the authorities did get involved and come to the scene, a lot of things weren't collected. Things weren't done properly. Is that correct, Joy?
Yes, ma'am. As far as I know, they have no evidence. I don't think.
Well, you know, well, 7 days later, 8 days later, what the hell were they thinking?
Right. Obviously, they weren't.
That's right. That's my point. I mean, how dare they? If this were their daughter or their relative, they'd be on it like white on rice. This is terrible. They have to stop this.
Right.
Investigators need to do their jobs and do it thoroughly. I don't care how big the town is, how small the county is, how less the manpower is. It doesn't matter. This is a person's life. This woman just didn't disappear, did she, Joy?
No, she didn't. And what is so amazing to me is that Lisa's mother told me tonight that this fellow was over at Lisa's house that Wednesday night. And so whenever the family friend had called at 10 and she told him that she had someone coming over, it was her boyfriend to bring that pregnancy test the next morning. But as to mine and Lisa's mother's knowledge, he never volunteered that information to the investigator.
Well, why would he?
Well, I know, but I mean, did they question him? That's my thing. And, you know, it's like now they say he's lawyered up and they can't make him talk. That is so frustrating to me. You know, this man holds the key to everything, and I understand that he wants to keep it hidden, but law enforcement has no control to make him come in and be questioned or, you know, even with his lawyer, they've set up an appointment with his lawyer and he doesn't show.
So he's lawyered up.
Right, he's lawyered up.
Okay, what about he's been in some relationships since Lisa went missing, right?
Yes, I'm assuming that's what I was told he was. And
you know, if there's a girlfriend listening as a guest today in the chat room who's dated this bozo, and you know who he is, you know, anonymously you can call in, or you can email us at thecrimelawyer@gmail.com. We won't go anywhere with the information. We don't have our IPs trapped or traced. But you know something out there. Somebody has to know something, you know, because someone like this, Denny and Delilah, they will slip up and say to somebody, you know, don't make me tell you what I did to somebody else. If a current relationship or a relationship after Lisa went missing, and they want to show their force or their power or their control, they'll intimidate them, won't they?
There was just a case I read just a couple of days ago where a girl that was in a relationship with this other man turned him in after something like 17 years. And, I mean, he knew about it all these years. She knew about it. But they were finally really splitting up, and she turned him in. So, I mean, these things happen. It's not something that these families give up hope. You can't give up hope because you don't know what the tiniest little clue is out there that you're going to get that's going to crack it wide open. Somebody knows, and somebody's going to come forward.
And isn't it, Denny, is this true, Denny, that perhaps in some cases that the person will keep a momentum of the person, something?
Yeah, yes. Some people will collect the little souvenirs or mementos of their victims or their act, and you know, they'll, you know, I don't know the psyche of it, but that's a very important thing too. And I just want to mention, as Delilah was just saying about time, we've had a guest on the show in the past from California who pursued trying to get justice for her daughter who was murdered. It was a cold case, and it took 9 years, and she kept you know, keeping the case open, keeping it out in public. She even started her own radio show and so forth. And because her philosophy was that, as it was just mentioned by Delilah, somebody knows something. Whoever knows what happened here has told someone else about it. Somebody knows, and if you can keep the story alive, as we were talking about in the previous segment, lightning can strike. It won't strike otherwise. The story's got to be kept out there, and the efforts and the pressure kept on, and it could be 5 years, 10 years, or we've seen cases over 20 years. But eventually, the person who knows either has a falling out with the person they protected. Maybe they've seen the light, developed religion, whatever. But circumstances change, and when they do, there's a chance that person will come forward. So there's always a chance that these cases can be solved. And I certainly hope this would be one of them because I get very frustrated with these cases, these people who disappear and are never seen again. And you know, just the story seems to go away. And that
right.
Annoys me.
And Joy, the person that was seeing her at the time that she disappeared, did he grow up and live right in the area where Lisa lived?
Yes.
So he's from that area?
Yes, and he's actually held a business in this area, and he's actually remarried now, or married now. And like I said last night,
what kind of business is he in?
Laying foundation houses for foundations for houses.
Oh, is that not surprising, guys? Wow.
Yeah.
Laying foundation. So that would mean, unearthing maybe some of his work somewhere down the road. Maybe somebody should go look at the records of his building permits and have them pulled on things that he's listed that he's worked on and look, because in all these cases, somebody isn't going to dispose of a body in any place that they are not familiar with, that they are sure that they can get away with. Recently, last week, Teresa Parker's body was finally discovered after 3.5 years. And Delilah, where was it?
Oh, very, very close to an area where he grew up.
Where he played with trains.
Exactly. It's, you know, this is one thing we were talking about in length. And most of these people or most of these guys who hide these bodies, you can almost bet it's a place that they are familiar with. They don't go too far away from their comfort zone because they know where all their secret hiding places are, whether it's someplace they grew up or someplace they knew as they were adults, but they think it's a secret place. So they're not going to take a body very often someplace that they don't know because they don't know that somebody else doesn't know where that place is. So it's usually very close. It's amazing to me how many cases that we've looked into like this that they have been found very close. Which brings me to a question for Joy: is this in a rural area?
Well, yes, kinda. It's we live in a small town in Beach Island where she went missing,
and that's near Aiken and North Augusta.
Yes, ma'am, and it's, I guess what some people would call, you know, out towards the country. It's a good ways from, you know, town, and there's a lot of wooded area there. And from what I'm being told, off of one of the roads, the major roads there, is where he was actually in the process of laying foundation for a house that week.
Do me a favor real quick. Give me this guy's initials. What are they? Just the initials.
B-H.
B-H.
Uh-huh.
B as in boy, H as in?
Henry. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So B-H, his initials are B-H. $10 says, everybody, that he is in our chat room somewhere under one of these guest labels, or his current wife is. So if you're listening, we'd like to be able to bring Lisa Shuttleworth home. And, you know, on your conscience, regardless, even if you give the information anonymously, whatever, do the right thing if you're listening, please. Or if you're related to this case and you're listening to the person who you suspect could possibly have done something, please give the information. Again, and also you can call the police department anonymously on this case as well. It's not, you know, they don't trace this stuff, do they, Denny, when you call them with a anonymous tip?
No.
And people think that they do, don't they, sometimes? They're afraid to do it, but you can do it from almost anywhere. And the Aiken Sheriff's Office is 1-800-922-9709. We'd like to be able to, you know, give her a proper burial and bring her home for her kids because, Joy, what is going on with her two children? How old were they when Mom went missing?
Ryan, I believe, was 9, and Christina is 22 now, and it's been 7 years ago. So, 14, 15. And both have been, you know, have been hospitalized for depression.
For very traumatic situations that's happened since Mom's gone.
Right, and, you know, Christina's gone through graduation, and, you know, she tells me now, you know, when I get married, my mom's not going to be there. When I have children, my mom's not going to be there. And, you know, Ryan made the comment because he was so young, what if I forget what my mama sounded like? I mean, and I couldn't, you know, it just tears me up inside. And I really don't think that this person, well, I know for one he doesn't care, but I don't think he understands how many people he's affected, and it wasn't just for a day. This is for the rest of their lives. Christina and Ron will never be the same. Never. And neither will Lisa's parents.
Has this person been officially named a person of interest?
Not that I'm aware of. His name's not been made public.
Has he taken a polygraph or been brought in for questioning in the past? What's happened to the polygraph test?
He failed the polygraph, and when they wanted to bring him back in for questioning, that's when he lawyered up. And so the investigators got in touch with his attorney and had set up a meeting to meet with him at the attorney's office. And when the investigators showed up, BH was not there. And so he's avoiding it. And, you know, my thing is, if, you know, if my boyfriend, or just say I'm him, and his girlfriend's pregnant, he's just found it out, you know, if he's supposed to care about her and love her, then, you know, why hasn't he contacted the family? Why didn't he help search for Lisa? Why wasn't he upset?
I don't know. I think in all these cases that we do, everyone, do any of these guys ever help look for their loved one?
Very rarely. I mean, we see it like Mark Hacking. He got out. He looked. He put on the act of being the distraught husband, but it didn't last that long. He cracked. And they usually do, one time or another, or they get away with it. They've done a lot of searches in that area, haven't they, Joy? A lot of land searches?
For Lisa, no, ma'am.
No searches have been done?
They've done, they said that they used a backhoe to dig in a swamp behind her father's business.
But what about the swamp behind her house?
The pond behind her house was not searched, and from what I was told, it was due to it being drained back in the 80s looking for a little boy, and it was too expensive, and then also that the landowner was not happy as far as having it drained.
That was my next question. Were there any landowners that did not give permission to search their land?
And, you know, whether this man, he or she, did or didn't, I'm not sure. That's just what we've been told. By the investigator, that, you know, he would rather us not. But to
And what's the investigator told you about his reference to Lisa Shuttleworth's case?
She is a file. She is a number. He cannot get personally involved.
Can you stop there 1 minute? A file and number. Denny, how upsetting is this? She's a file and a number. He can't get personally involved. What the hell's his job done?
Yeah, you know, we hear this stuff over and over, and it just makes my blood boil. It's hard for me to fathom this. It really truly is, and I really think if we were talking or in the previous segment, getting whenever it can be done, getting the media involved to follow up and ask the tough questions to some of these people and agencies is, what have you been doing, or why haven't you done such and such? Because everybody needs to be held accountable, including the authorities.
Right. I actually wrote a letter to the person of interest that if we have time, I would like to read to him if he's listening.
You know what? Let's do it now.
Okay. To the person that took Lisa away, I wish I knew why you felt the need to take Lisa from us. What could she have ever done to you to make you want to hurt her and take her away from her family? Did you really realize how many lives you would be hurting? How many lives would be changing? I wish you could hear the pain in Lisa's daughter's voice as she talks about how hard it is to be without her mother, how much she misses her. Would you even care? I pray that you have a soul and that maybe one day you will feel some guilt and come forward and give us the answers that we need. But I find that happening very doubtful. If you had a soul, you would never have taken her. You have a mother, maybe a sister. Imagine how you would feel not knowing where they were, what happened to them. Would you wonder, like us, if they suffered? Were they scared? Are their remains laying in the woods somewhere, unable to be found? Would you? Those are the things that run through our minds every day. Did she know that she would never see her children again? What a horror for a mother. How could you take her? I won't say that I hate you. God doesn't allow me to hate. But I can tell you that the punishment that you are trying to hide from on this earth will be nothing compared to what awaits you when your life ends. You may think you're smart. You have gone unknown for 7 years. But I can tell you that you will be caught. You may be able to hide from law enforcement, but you can't hide from God. And with God's strength, we will continue to look for Lisa. We will find her. And I don't care if it's 20 years from now. You will be brought to justice. No one can keep a secret from it forever. And no one does something like what you've done without telling someone. I pray that God weighs heavy on your heart to do the right thing.
When she went missing, did anybody see him in the next couple of weeks, like from immediately from the point of the police report being made or the call being made that she was missing? Did someone take a look at him to see him? Did he have any injuries or marks? Because, you know, maybe she fought back. Maybe, you know, she defended herself in some way. Did anybody see if he was torn up or hurt in any way?
There's not been any talk of that I've heard, or Lisa's parents.
But and what happens too in these cases is because the police haven't responded in 7 whole days at back in 2003, time is elapsed. People aren't, you know, thinking about who's involved, what's going on. So Denny, how important is it to start making a list real quick and start, if you can, get the police's ear to say, this person we think was last with them, you know, that you need to go and question them now. Or is it safe for the family member or a friend to go and try to, without interfering with their personal liberty, to try to see if they're hurt in some way or if they have a scratch on them somehow, and maybe even try to snap a picture with your camera? Is that possible?
It's possible, but, you know, people, you got to be a little careful there. For a person who doesn't know exactly what they're doing, is not in the investigative business, and has emotional.
But nobody's done anything. It's been seven. Let's say it's the first day, and police aren't, you know, coming out for 7 days. Can I do something as a family member? Is that possible?
Yeah, sure. As long as you don't violate any laws, you know, trespassing or assault or something. But yes, if the choice is, if the options are to just do nothing and have this person escape, or not escape, but get by for 5, 6, 7, 10 days before anybody looks at him or her or talks to him or her, then certainly, you know, it isn't necessarily the best option, but certainly it's something that should be pursued because, again, once it's gone, if there were marks, if there were bruises or injuries or what have you, once they're healed and gone, you've lost them. So, If you can't get the authorities to respond in a timely manner, then as if it were my family, my loved one, yes, I would try to do something on my own to get
but
the
I think too we come a lot of times with this information from a standpoint of people who have been educated or who know what to do. A lot of these families, when someone goes missing or a tragedy like this happens, they're not thinking. I mean, they don't think about taking pictures or
exactly.
Work in their own case. We've seen it time after time, and now we know if this happens, here's what we've got to do. But the general public doesn't. You have no idea unless it's happened to you. And most people don't pay attention to what we're trying to say, and it's unfortunate because it could happen to anybody. In the blink of an eye, your life has changed, and you don't think about what it is I should be doing in an investigation because, first of all, you're not trained to do that. You trust that the law enforcement agencies are there to do this. So a lot of times in these kind of cases, everything gets lost. Everything gets lost in the first 48.
We are running out of time. Joy, we're going to hook you up with Gene Cervani's group, Crime Survivor, Citizens Against Homicide, and some other folks to get this information in the newsletter. And Denny's going to pass on your information to them, okay?
Okay.
And then we're going to see what other things that we can do. Thank you so much.
Well, God bless, and thank you all.
Keep it up. Keep up the fight. Don't give up. Keep us updated, please, as to what's going on.
I will.
All right. Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, and public relations team, ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, October 5th, 2010. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
And thank you for joining us tonight on CrimeWire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on CrimeWire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And you can hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show at www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Just turn on the volume of your computer and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard. When there's nowhere else to turn, visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. Good night. God bless from the CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci, Denny Griffin, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you.
And Delilah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Good night. Good night.